everyone, and welcome to Building the Machine, a new podcast series from Red Leg Nation Radio. Over the next 12 episodes, we're going to bring you the story of the Big Red Machine, Cincinnati's baseball dynasty that changed the game forever. Day by day, year by year, you'll see how the machine was constructed, all the highs, all the lows, and the legacy that remains even to this day. Each week, we'll be bringing you a new episode focusing on a single year, from 1969 to 1979. If you didn't get to experience the Big Red Machine as they were dominating baseball, you're going to enjoy the chance to experience the story as if you were there and learn more about the names and events that were so important in shaping the narrative around the Cincinnati Reds. We'll also include thoughts on what was different about baseball in that era, from salary negotiations to the way the game was played, to the things that happened that made this team become what it became. Now, if you were fortunate enough to watch the machine live, this should be a fun blast from the past. I'm Chad Dotson, and joining me now to discuss 1969 and the early stages of the construction of the Big Red Machine is Bill Lack. Bill, tell me a little bit more about this podcast and let our listeners know exactly how this project came to be.
Well, it's kind of an offshoot of the Pennant podcast that you've been doing. And you and I had kind of talked about them, and I kind of came up with this idea of doing them year by year in the Big Red Machine, and you and I talked about it, and we thought it kind of could be a fun idea and talk about how the Big Red Machine came into being. And I think I'm probably the only one of the guys that does a podcast that's old enough to remember any of these players or any of these teams. And so we're going to jump into this and see what happens.
Well, I'm excited about it, and the reason why I thought it was interesting when you first brought the idea to me was that, you know, I learned this when Chris Garber and I were researching our book, The Big 50. This, you know, the Big Red Machine kind of hovers over the Cincinnati Reds organization. But these days, there's not that many people that really truly remember what exactly happened. And we found lots of anecdotes there, and we're hardcore Reds fans that we didn't know about these teams. And so I thought it'd be fun to have put down this document, basically, just really go year by year and talk about what it took to build that Big Red Machine. And how it became what it was and its legacy today for those of you that, you know, didn't experience it or that don't know that much about it. Thought it'd be a fun way to look at it. So we're going to begin with 1969. That was some kind of year, huh, Bill?
It was in a very exciting year, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Reds, and we're going to go into the 68 a little bit just because to set up 69. But we're also going to talk about our favorite baseball book, because that was 1969 when that took place, and there are some Reds factors in that book.
Absolutely, that's one of the things we're going to be talking about today. Let's talk now about the calendar year 69, a big year not just for baseball and for the Cincinnati Reds, but also for the United States and the world. First moon landing was in 1969, the Apollo 11 mission. Neil Armstrong. What do you think about that, Bill?
If you weren't alive at that time, you really can't understand. I don't think you can grasp how exciting the space race and the space program was for young kids, young guys, you know, young people like I was. I was in 69. I was 11 years old, and I had my model, you know, Saturn V and the lunar module and all that stuff. So, I mean, you, unless you were alive at the time, I don't think you can really grasp how exciting this was.
A lot of you kids out there are going to be surprised that also in 1969, the first message was sent over ARPANET, which essentially marked the creation of the Internet. Did you have the Internet in 1969, Bill?
No, I didn't live right next door to Al Gore.
You didn't have any Wi-Fi at your home?
No, I didn't. And Al Gore hadn't hooked me up yet.
He invented the Internet. That's true. Some of the things that happened that year, the first ATM was installed in Rockville Center, New York. The Beatles gave their final public performance and then later in the year released Abbey Road. So coming to the end of the Beatles, but still a landmark year for the greatest rock band in history, right?
Absolutely. The rooftop concert at Apple Records.
Right.
And it was, if you've never seen videotape of that, I'm sure it's available on YouTube or something. It's pretty cool.
Absolutely. The Woodstock Festival took place in New York. Now, did you attend the Woodstock Festival, Bill?
I was a little young for Woodstock.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Plus, I don't like mud.
Plenty of that was available. Plenty of mud and free love. Woodstock, 1969. The Vietnam War raged on, obviously, and that was probably the biggest headline, certainly in America, during that year. And it was a big year for the Vietnam War, as much as you can say it was a big year, right?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing to me was that the Paris peace talks began. Of course, they ran on for three more years before the Americans left Vietnam. But it was the beginning of the beginning of the end, and the last major battle, American battle, was fought that year on Hamburger Hill in Vietnam, in the Ashu Valley.
Yeah, I think that was the year the first troop withdrawals were actually made. So maybe it was the point where the America was in the process of extracting itself from that war. That year, Richard Nixon sworn in as the 37th president of the United States. Move on to pop culture. A lot of interesting things in pop culture right around then. Got The Godfather. I'm talking about the novel by Mario Puzo was released that year to wide acclaim. Did you ever read The Godfather, Bill?
I just reread it recently.
It holds up. I read it. It's been a few years now, but it's pretty good, right?
It's excellent. If you can say it's better, any movie is better than the movie Godfather, the book is really, really good.
Yeah, it's outstanding, and I would encourage anyone to read that. In music, Led Zeppelin released their first album, self-titled album, that year. And Chicago. You big Chicago fan, Bill?
I'm a huge Chicago fan. Having been the world's worst high school trombone player, I've been a Chicago fan since they released their first album, which they released in 69, Chicago Transit Authority. And also that year, the Who released Tommy.
So big year in music. Now, but let's clarify for our listeners. You say you're a big fan of Chicago. You don't mean the Cubs.
No, I mean the band.
Oh, okay. All right. In television, The Brady Bunch premiered along with Sesame Street, Monty Python's Flying Circus. All those premiered in 69. And Bill, you came up with my favorite one. What else premiered that year?
Scooby-Doo.
Oh, Scooby-Dooby-Doo. Where are you? Fantastic. Now, in movies, Midnight Cowboy was released. It ended up winning Best Picture. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in some ways changed movie making as well. Big year for movies. What else was out there that year?
Well, Midnight Cowboy was the first X-rated, and I think the only X-rated movie to ever win the Best Picture award. And I've never seen Midnight Cowboy.
I've seen it. It was Best Picture. It was a picture.
Yeah. And also that year, Easy Rider was released. True Grit, which won John Wayne an Academy Award.
Yeah, Best Actor, John Wayne.
Yep. And you and I are both big Bond fans. And On Her Majesty's Secret Service came out that year. And the big thing in that movie to me was Diane Rigg. Diane Rigg was in it. I mean, I was in love with her from The Avengers.
What I liked about that movie, or what's interesting about the movie, is George Lazenby in his only outing as James Bond 007, and really pretty good Bond, underrated.
Yep, he was a good Bond for an Australian Bond, but apparently he was pretty hard to work with.
He was.
Considering he had no acting experience, and he was a model, I believe.
Yeah, and then demanded a 7-picture deal after it was over. They said, no. And so in the next movie, which was Diamonds Are Forever, Sean Connery returned to the role. 1969 as well, the Manson family murders, those were committed. If you saw the recent movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you got some sort of an alternate ending to those, but the Manson family murders. In baseball, we're going to talk a little bit more maybe about some of this, but I do want to mention, because the biggest things to me that in baseball, outside of what we're going to talk about in the podcast, Willie Mays hitting his 600th home run, joining Babe Ruth as the only two to go over 600 at that time, and the Montreal Expos became the first Major League Baseball team outside the United States. So that pretty well wraps up 1969, but that's time to talk about the Cincinnati Reds in 69. And to do that, we really kind of need to go back to 1968 and the things that were changing in baseball between 68 and 69 that sets up the creation of the Big Red Machine.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to me is that 68 had been the year of the pitcher. It was the most dominant year of pitching in the modern era. The National League leader in ERA was Bob Gibson. He had a 1.12 ERA. Louis Tiant, who we'll hear a lot more about later in a few episodes, at that time was pitching for Cleveland. He led the American League with a 1.60. But the big thing was 7 starters had an ERA below 2.
You're the pitcher.
Yeah. Carl Yastrzemski led the American League in batting with a .301 batting average.
That'll get it done.
Yeah. Denny McClain won 30 games that year, but that, I mean, whether that hit, you know, we know about wins and loss, you know, wins for pitchers,
right.
But
still,
he's the last 30-game winner in baseball.
And it came that year.
Yep. you know, what they did to battle this dominant. Yeah, they lowered the mound from 15 inches to 10 inches, and they also restored the pre-63 strike zone, where before it had been shoulders to knees. They went to the top of the knees to the armpits. It apparently did make a difference, because in 69, the average offensive runs went from 6.84 a game to 8.14 a game. So apparently the movements, the changes they made did make a difference.
I mentioned the Montreal Expos earlier, but it was the first expansion for the Major League Baseball since 1961. And so you have these changes in the height of the mound and changes designed to help the hitters, but you also dilute the pitching staffs around the league a little bit more as well by adding some expansion teams, right?
Yeah, and that could have had as much to do with that change in statistics and runs per game as anything else they did. In fact, if I remember right, in ball four, doesn't Bowden talk about he really thinks lower in the mound gives the pitchers a bigger advantage because you're closer to the plate?
That was his contention, and who's to argue with Jim Bowden?
Yeah.
And that year, the National League added San Diego and Montreal, San Diego Padres and the Montreal Expos. The American League added a team in Kansas City. You may know who that team is. And then Seattle, but not the Mariners, as my young friend called them as we were growing up. The Seattle Pilots. And that's where ball four comes back into it, right?
Yep. And if you haven't read ball four, shame on you. Get the book. Read the book. Because it holds up well. The humor holds up well. And it's a good snapshot of baseball at the time.
Well, and it was a completely honest snapshot. Jim Bowden had been a former All-Star pitcher with the Yankees, and he was kind of trying to hang on as a knuckleball pitcher at that time with the expansion Seattle Pilots. And he memorialized the whole year, and it was a real inside story, inside study of clubhouse and the way things happened in the hotels and in the on the buses. And it was just, if you haven't read it, I cannot recommend it more highly. Ball 4 by Jim Bowden. So.
Yep. And the other thing that happened that year was not only did the major leagues expand, but for the first time they expanded the playoffs and divided the leagues into divisions.
Yeah, and you know, we complained about the wild card when they added the wild card, although that's been a while back now. And every time they fiddle with the playoffs, we complain. But that's a huge change. Whereas just one team from each league was in the World Series. Now all of a sudden you have a second another round of playoffs, and then you have teams that weren't the top team in the league having a chance to make it to the World Series. That was a huge change.
Oh yeah, you doubled the number of teams in the playoffs. And the other thing that was kind of strange is the way that at least the National League was aligned. And I've heard stories about that there was some politics about St. Louis and Chicago wanting to stay in the same division. And have old rivalries with like the Mets, with the New York team, at least with the New York teams. And that's why the Reds and the Braves ended up in the NL West while St. Louis and Chicago were in the NL East. The lineup in the American League made a lot more sense, except they put both the expansion teams into the NL West.
Right, right, right. And for years, I could never understand why the Reds were in the National League West growing up. And as it turned out, that became a big part of the narrative for what the Big Red Machine would be, in that they're with the Dodgers in the National League West, and those two teams really became the teams that were battling every single year. So who knows what it would have been like if they'd been in the East, as they really should have been, frankly.
Yeah, you might have had a lot more interesting NLCSs if you'd had the Reds and the Dodgers playing in the NLCS rather than battling out over 162 games for one spot.
Right, it's a great point. It's a great point. So again, baseball on its own was in a state of transition at that time. And the Reds were kind of in a state of transition as well. They had made it to the World Series in 61, but had been, kind of a, up and down since then. And we get to 1968, and they finished the year 1968. They're fourth place in the National League. And again, that was before division. So 83-79, four games above. Some things changed, I guess, from 68 to 69. And let's talk a little bit, if we could, Bill, about the roster moves that the Reds made after the season, because a lot of them have real impact on what would happen, not just the following year, but with the way the Big Red Machine was developed.
Absolutely. To me, the biggest trade was one made in early October with the Cardinals, where the Reds traded off, a guy that was a legend in Cincinnati at the time, Vada Pinson. Who was just a great player. He's one of those guys that many people say is a borderline Hall of Famer. over the course of his career. If nothing else, he'd be at the top of the Hall of Very, Very Good. But he was getting a little older, and the Reds traded him for Bobby Tolan and Wayne Granger, two guys that were key to the Reds' early success as the Big Red Machine.
Yeah, you could look back at this one as sort of the way we analyzed the Frank Robinson trade to Baltimore. You know, an old 30. He was just 29 then his last year, Beta Pinson was, with the Cincinnati Reds, and really had, coming up at age 19, had been an outstanding, just a mainstay in the Reds' outfield for more than a decade. And so that trade, probably if we had a podcast in October of 1968, we'd have been screaming about it, you know, at that time. Although Tolan had some perceived value, and Wayne Granger ended up really being a contributor there for a while. You know, it's when we're trading away a guy that's a clear Reds Hall of Famer. And very, very
popular in town.
Extremely popular, and that could have gone another way, and we'll talk a little more about how it did go for the Reds as we go throughout this series. But, you know, Wayne Granger in particular, in 1970, I guess, was really instrumental, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He became he had two or three really good years for the Reds, and I'm not sure of this without looking it up, but I think he was also Fireman of the Year one of the years he was with the Reds.
Yeah, so, you know, trading Veda Pinson ultimately, it was kind of putting a stamp on or closing the book on the Reds of the early to mid-60s, because Pinson and Frank Robinson and that bunch had really been the guys that got the Reds to the World Series in 61. And Pinson was that last link to those successful teams of the early 60s. And so, really, we're talking about building the machine, and that's a point where you can look at and say, okay, here we're really turning a page, and this is really, in a lot of ways, a new era of Red. And that's why we're starting. Everybody thinks of the Big Red Machine as the 70s, but that's why we think it has to begin in late 68 and 69, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like this, you know, the next trade that we're going to talk about a little bit here, that happened in November. The Reds traded their starting shortstop, Leo Cardenas, to the Twins for Jim Merritt. In a few years, you know, we'll have a shortstop that becomes, again, many people think he's a Hall of Famer, borderline Hall of Famer, whatever, and Davey Concepcion. But Cardenas had been at shortstop for a number of years for the Reds, was a very popular player in town, was a pretty good ball player, and they traded him for a guy that ends up becoming the Reds' next 20-game winner.
Yeah, thank you very much for mentioning that, because Cardenas fits that exact same profile. You know, he was really a part-time player in 61, but remember those good Reds teams? He played 9 years and was a four-time All-Star in Cincinnati. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a legit, really good player. Age 29, he's out the door. And you're right, there are two big things about that. Number one, they get Jim Merritt, who we'll talk about in some length. But also, the point you make is that it's really paving the way for the next great Red shortstop, and a sort of a line of great shortstops we had there for a while. Cardenas was a great one, and Concepcion becomes so key to the Big Red Machine.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see that this is kind of a Bob Housem theory. I guess is the Branch Rickey theory, is you'd rather trade a guy, you know, a year too early than a year too late. And so when they get to be around 30, if he thinks it's time to move a guy, you know, that he can help the team, that's what he's going to do.
Yeah, and since you mentioned Bob Housem, I do want to note that I think in one of our future episodes, we're going to have a little segment on Bob Housem, because we really do need to talk about Bob Housem and how important he was in constructing the machine, and how some of his decisions contributed to how the Big Red Machine ended up. So we're going to go into that in a future episode, but Bob Housem's name is going to be sprinkled all throughout every episode of this series, I'm sure.
Absolutely, and I mean, he's the architect. He and the scouting department is the other thing we're going to talk about that can't be talked about too much when you're talking about the building of the machine.
Absolutely, without question. What's the next transaction we need to look at?
The only other one here that they got Jimmy Stewart, who ends up being a part of the big trade in 72.
He was great in Hitchcock's Rear Window.
No, it's not him. It's not the one with Grace Kelly. It's super sub Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
And then they also traded Ted Abernathy, who'd been a good reliever for the Reds, and they got Bill Plummer, who would be a part of the Big Red Machine teams in the mid-70s. Never a really big player. In fact, I heard a joke one time about Bill Plummer that they kept him around for the fights.
You know, Bill Plummer, he's one of my favorite characters in Reds history, because he played with the Reds for 8 years. But over those 8 years, he got a total of 899 plate appearances. He hit 186 during his time with the Reds. You know, he never played more than 65 games was his high water mark. But yet he was a member of the Big Red Machine and was there on the team throughout all those years. I guess if you're behind, the Reds had some other catcher, I guess, and when you're behind a guy that's as good as him, you're not going to play much. But yeah, Bill Plummer.
It's kind of hard to get a whole lot of playing time when you're playing behind the guy that's the greatest of all time at your position.
It's a little difficult, absolutely. And before we get into the sort of day-to-day of the Reds in 1969 and sort of discuss how the season played out, I wanted to talk about a couple things. First of all, I want to just go ahead and let's discuss who the starting lineup and the regular starters and the starting pitchers. Then I want to talk about Dave Bristol, who is the Reds manager. Now, the regular starting lineup, catcher Johnny Bench.
He was okay.
He was all right. First base, Lee May.
The Big Bopper from Birmingham.
The Big Bopper. Second base, Tommy Helms.
An all-star.
Third base, Tony Perez.
He could hit.
Shortstop that year, taking over from Leo Cardenas, was Woody Woodward.
Who goes on to become a general manager in Seattle, I believe?
Yes, that's correct. Left fielder, Alex Johnson. I know we're going to talk about him a little bit more as well. An interesting what-if name to me in Reds history. Bobby Tolan, the center fielder.
Who had just come over. We talked about him.
Pete Rose in right field.
He was pretty good. He'd won a batting title there going in.
He was all right. And then the primary starting pitchers for the Reds in 1969, Jim Merritt, who went 17-9. Tony Cloninger.
Who had come over in a trade from the Braves.
Jim Maloney, who was 29 that year. He was really the only holdover for any length of time from those earlier teams. He kind of bridged the gap between eras. I would say Jim Maloney's the one guy that did that.
Yep.
21-year-old Gary Nolan.
Who was a fireballer. And we'll be talking a lot about Gary Nolan in the next few years.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Wayne Granger, Clay Carroll, those were your primary relievers. Jack Fisher. So that's the 69 Reds. Now, the skipper of these teams, because he, to me, is one of the interesting names in Reds history that's kind of forgotten a little bit. And I think Dave Bristol really needs to get a little bit of credit for what happened with the Big Red Machine, right?
Oh, absolutely. And Rose said Dave was absolutely instrumental in the building of the Big Red Machine. He put the pieces in place. He said Sparky was the best manager I ever played for, but Dave Bristol had a big hand in the Big Red Machine. When Bristol took over the Reds in July of 66, he was the youngest manager in Major League Baseball. The Reds were never under 500 with Bristol as a manager. And he had managed a lot of these guys that were big leaguers at this time. He managed a lot of them in the minor leagues. He had come up through the Reds system. And like I said, he never finished below 500 with the Reds. And then once he left the Reds, he never had another team that finished over 500.
You know, you wonder about Dave Bristol because you're right. Pete Rose and other Reds really give Bristol big credit for what he did, and he ended up being replaced after this year. But you wonder what he could have done with the Big Red Machine. And we're going to talk a lot over this series about the what ifs, and that's one of them to me. What if Dave Bristol had been given a chance to manage these guys, and he did come up through the system with a lot of them, and would it have been different? Would it have been better? Would it have been worse? I don't think we know. As much as we love Sparky Anderson,
pretty tough to make the case that it could have been better.
That's a good point. Sparky did okay, huh?
Yeah, he did okay.
All right, let's move into the regular season here, and we'll begin with April 7th, opening day, the 100th anniversary season of professional baseball. How'd the Reds do that day?
Well, they got beat.
So it's going to be a bad year.
Yeah, you know, you can't win them all if you don't win the first one.
That's what they tell me. So lost 3-2 to the Dodgers before 30,111 at Crosley Field.
And surprisingly, the Reds opening day started that day was Gary Nolan.
21 years old.
And struck out 12.
In seven innings, right, but took the loss.
Yep.
I note that Pete Rose started that day center field that day. It's the fifth straight year he had started at a different position on opening day. That's got no one's ever going to match that, I'm sure. That's amazing. Center field, and you don't ever remember Pete Rose ever playing much center field. He was very speedy, but...
You also have to remember they were playing in Crosley, much smaller outfield.
That's true. Let's fast forward to April the 15th. The Reds beat the Giants 11-10 that day in a 12-inning showdown at Crosley Field. Reds scored 3 in the ninth to tie the game at 8, And then San Francisco scored two in the 10th. The Reds tied the game again. Winning run scored when Alex Johnson tripled. And then Johnny Bench singled. Can we talk about Alex Johnson for a moment?
He could hit.
He's a guy that just, you know, he was, 26 years old that year. Ended up hitting 315, 350 on base, 17 homers. I mean, this is a guy that was, and then the following year was an all-star, although not with the Reds, but this was a guy that, I don't know, he was one that at the time, again, if we were podcasting at that time, you'd say, this guy needs to be a centerpiece of the next Reds team, right?
You mentioned the next year, and he won the batting title the next year.
That's right.
In the American League.
It's interesting that the Reds, and we'll talk about him getting dealt away before we begin our next episode, but for this season, he was a key contributor on this team that a lot of Reds fans this day and age don't remember because he was gone from the Reds at age 26 and really only spent two seasons in Cincinnati, 68 and 69, and was awfully good in both of those years.
Well, and at least early on in the season, I can't remember all season whether he was, but at least early on in the season, he was their three hitter.
That's saying something. There's some pretty good hitters on that team.
Yeah. You know, he had a career that kind of tailed pretty quickly. You know, by the time he was 30 was his last, above, you know, around 30, 31 was about the time he was pretty finished. And he had a couple bad years in 71 and 72. My memory of him was that there was talk of he had an attitude problem. And that was one of the reasons the Reds traded him. But there isn't any doubt about the fact that this guy knew what to do with the stick.
We probably won't spend much of our time complaining about the Reds trading him because it worked out. But Alex Johnson needs to be remembered by Reds fans. Now, later that month, the end of the month, April 30th, Jim Maloney pitched a no-hitter. And some argument, it's officially, I think, his second no-hitter by the record books. But in some ways, it was his third career no-hitter, right?
Yep. I think he had one that went into 10 innings. And because he gave up a hit in the 10th inning, it didn't count as a no-hitter or something like that. And it's just crazy.
That was actually June 14th, 1965. He no-hit the Mets for 10 innings and then allowed a hit in the 11th.
Have I ever told you my Jim Maloney story?
You may have, but you haven't told all of our listeners, so go ahead.
Well, for one thing, we have an interview on file at Red Leg Nation Radio that we did with Jim Maloney a few years ago.
It was great.
And it was very, very good. I was very excited to do that. But when I was a kid, and this is even, you know, before 69, this has probably been in 64, 65, 66 in there. My grandparents managed an apartment complex over on the west side of Cincinnati. And a lot of the Reds lived there at the time. Rose lived there. Maloney lived there. Don Pavletic, Jim Coker, Darren Johnson, Art Shamsky lived there. And my grandpa, they'd always ask my grandpa if he wanted to go to the ballgame. And my grandpa took me to the Reds game one night, and they had a giveaway where the players went up in the stands, and every player had a prize assigned to them. And the players went up into the stands and shook hands with the fans. And when they sounded this horn, whoever the player was shaking hands with, they won that player's prize. Well, Maloney knew where my grandpa was sitting, and he stayed like right close to him. And when the horn started to sound, he ripped his hand away from the guy he was shaking his hand with and whips around and grabs my grandpa's hand so my grandpa would win a television set.
Yes. Fantastic.
And a few years later, I ended up with that television set. So it worked out for the best for me.
And the moral of the story is?
Cheaters do prosper.
Cheaters. Wait a minute. I'm not sure that's the actual lesson we want all the children listening to Red Leg Nation Radio to learn, but Jim Maloney's television. You still watch that television, right?
No, I don't have it anymore. It was a nice black and white. It was about, I would guess it was like a 24 inch or something. It was
glorious. So Jim Maloney throws his no-hitter, officially his second no-hitter, in a 10-0 win over the Astros at Crosley Field on that day. Struck out 13, walked 5, and even drove in a run. Something happened interesting the next day as well. Another no-hitter, right?
Yeah. Only the bad guys pulled it off the next day when Don Wilson no-hit the Reds.
Yeah, that wasn't quite as much fun. I don't remember watching that one on MLB.tv, but I would not have been happy.
No, you probably wouldn't have.
Yeah, so only the second time in history there's been no-hitters in consecutive games involving the same two teams. So we move into May. You know, as the Reds finish up April, they're doing okay. They're doing all right. Finish up April right around 500. Not exactly where they hoped they would be, but they're hanging in there. And then May 3rd and May 4th, to me, something that we'll never see these days, right?
Right. The Reds had a pitcher named Tony Kloninger, and he was kind of a big, stocky guy. And he was one of them. And back in these days, you didn't really have specialized, you know, pitchers. So he started this day on May the 3rd against the Padres at Crosley. He doesn't even get out of the first inning. He doesn't get an out. He gives up three hits and two walks and ends up giving up five runs because Jim Merritt gets beat up right behind him. Jim Merritt only gets one out. So the Reds are on their third pitcher and they're still in the first inning. And they end up giving up nine runs and getting beat 13-5. So Kloninger's gotten beat up. And this is on a Saturday, I assume probably a Saturday evening, because there's only 4,900 people in the ballpark. And then the next day, they're playing a doubleheader. And in the second game of the doubleheader, Kloninger throws a complete game, two-hit shutout against the same team.
The very next day. Yeah, you're right. You'll never see that that these days.
I don't think it's in here, because I don't think it's in these box scores. I wonder how many pitches he threw in the game that he didn't get an out.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Yeah.
Oh man, so Tony Kloninger setting records that you'll never see anymore.
He was a good hitting pitcher.
He was, as a matter of fact, past Michael Lorenzen, right? That's what we'll call him.
Without the biceps.
Well, nobody's got the Mikey biceps, so, you know. Nobody's like that. May 9th, the Reds play their first regular season game outside of the United States and beat the Montreal Expos 8-5 in a game shortened by rain. So the
Jerry Park,
where they played until later in the 70s when they moved to Olympic Stadium. So yeah. I don't remember Jerry Park, anything about that, but the ballparks of that era are, I guess maybe in some ways they are similar to the parks we have these days in terms of dimensions and things like that, because we've had this retro craze for the last 20 years.
The stands were not. I remember the outfield at Jerry Park looked like a high school bleacher.
Right. And then we're coming into the era very soon of all the multi-purpose stadiums. So these are the last years of these old stadiums that, you're right, in a lot of instances look like something. If you go back and look at the pictures and the videos, look like something you couldn't even believe. They're playing Major League Baseball on. We don't realize how good we have it these days.
And it's interesting, if you like, I'm looking at the Expos box score from this game. The guys that were playing for the Expos at the time, Maury Wills, who'd been a great for the Dodgers for years and years and years, Rusty Staub, Mac Jones, who had been a Red the previous year, Don Clendenin, who would go on and be a star for the Mets in the World Series this year, Mudcat Grant, who pitched for the Pirates. They were all on this Expos team.
Mudcat Grant, man. We don't have nicknames like that anymore.
Catfish and Mudcat.
I know, right?
We don't have those good nicknames anymore.
No, we sure don't. Late May, 24th, 25th, 28th, the Big Bopper had a little bit of a run there, didn't he?
Yeah, he did all right. He hit like six home runs over three games. Two of them were against the Expos and one was against the Pirates. He went 6-for-10 with six home runs.
That'll get it done.
Yeah, that's not a bad 3 days.
And he walked twice that time, too, so he was on base 8 out of 12 times. Yeah, that's a good month for a lot of people.
Yeah. That's a career for some guys.
Yeah, really. No question about it. Now, I love, as we move on to May 30th, something that you wouldn't see too often. You may still see it someday, but not if the powers that be have their way and introduce the designated hitter to the National League. But Clay Carroll, on May 30th, hits a 10th inning home run to beat the Cardinals 4-3 in St. Louis.
His only home run he ever hit.
His only home run he ever hit. And who did he hit it off of?
Well, this guy had a pretty good career.
He was okay.
Yeah, his name was Gibson. Yeah. He pitched for the Cardinals.
Bob Gibson, who the year before had been the greatest pitcher on the planet and was still among those names in 1969. Clay Carroll, Reds pitcher, hits a 10th inning home run to beat him.
At that time, Gibson's ERA was 1.74.
Gosh, full count, 10th inning. That's fantastic.
Well, and Carroll did that on top of throwing three hitless innings and getting the win.
That's right. That's right. that'll play, man. That'll play.
That's a pretty good day.
And that game was the eighth of nine consecutive wins for the Reds. They're at the low water mark of four games under 500, 8.5 games out. And that was on May 17th. But by the end of the month, they're five games over and in third place, 3.5 games out. So the big nine game winning streak, and they're starting to make a little bit of noise in the National League West, right?
Yeah, they are. And as we'll talk about a little later, this pennant race stays tight all the way to late September.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, you know, for the Reds, it was a chance to, I guess maybe with the divisional status of the leagues, a lot more teams were in pennant races, but it was a fun time to be a Reds fan, frankly.
It was getting to be a fun time. And that, you know, that season was just one of those ones where you were scoreboard watching from July on.
Yeah.
And checking the, you know, box scores and the standings every day.
What's that like?
Well, I hope we find out again here soon.
I do too. I hope so. So moving to June, and you know, June, the Reds stayed competitive throughout the month, but really the biggest thing we want to point out was in terms of building the machine, the draft was on June the 5th, and the Reds picked some guys that were absolutely instrumental in what the machine would become, right?
Yeah, they got Ken Griffey Sr. out of Pennsylvania. They drafted Raleigh Eastwick, and this young kid out of Kentucky that was an all around athlete. His name was Don Gullett. They all had pretty good careers.
Yeah, and all three were key parts of the Reds World Series winning teams in the 70s. So that's a pretty good draft. You know, we measure the Reds drafts these days. You know, now I'm going to start saying if you don't get three guys the caliber of Don Gullett, Raleigh Eastwick, and Ken Griffey Sr. every year, it's a wasted year as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's the beginnings of the Bob Hausman scouting system taking effect for the Reds, I think.
Oh, that's a great great point, no question. So we get to Independence Day that year. The Reds are five games back, still hovering about five games over, and they beat the Dodgers on July 4th. That day we want to identify not only because the Reds won and it was Independence Day and that's always fun, but there was something else kind of momentous about that day. You want to talk about that?
It seems like that was the first day the nickname Big Red Machine was used in print.
It was used by Los Angeles Herald Examiner reporter Bob Hunter in his game recap in the next day's paper wrote, Bristol, the boy manager of the Big Red Machine, took Tony Cloninger out with two on and one down in the ninth. So that seems to have been the first time that it appeared in print. Didn't really stick until later, I don't think, but when Bob Hertzel of the Cincinnati Inquirer started using it, and he used it on a front page story on the Reds in August. Can we talk for just a moment about that name, the Big Red Machine? There have been a lot of dynasties in the history of sports, but can you really have an actual dynasty that's memorable throughout the eras if you don't have a name? And that name is just beautiful, isn't it?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, that, you know, the 27 Yankees were sluggers, murderers row. But the, you know, the A's had won three World Series in a row and they didn't really have a nickname that I remember, except, you know, everybody said they needed a haircut.
Right. the early 70s.
Into that.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I think that's a, you know, the Reds were obviously great on the field and they were a legitimate dynasty and have a real argument for being the greatest dynasty in the history of baseball. But the reason, it seems to me like a big part of the reason they endure to this day is just that name is just, you know, the Big Red Machine. It's why we remember the Nasty Boys. You know, these names help connect through the eras. So
Chris Sabo was Spuds.
That's true. He was Spuds.
Yeah.
We'll do that in our series on the 1990s Reds. No, we're not going to do a series on the Reds of the 90s because there was a couple of good years in there. But
overall, it'd be just too depressing to talk about.
A lot of heartache. So July 19th, this was a huge one. On July 19th, the Reds are down 9-0 to the Astros, and they come back to win 10-9 in 11 innings. Bobby Tolan had five runs batted in. That was his first year with the Reds, and he had we talked about him just briefly earlier, but, man, really solid year for the Reds, right?
Well, he had an OPS plus of 124. He stole 26 bases. He got thrown out 12 times, but, he hit 21 home runs for him. Now, they were still playing in Crosley then, so I'm guessing a lot of those balls were dumped into the sun deck out there in right field.
He also had 10 triples, 305 average.
Drove in 93.
At the age of 23 as well.
Yeah, and he had a 5.4 WAR.
5.4 wins above replacement, although that was only the fourth best on the Reds that season because three effective Hall of Famers were ahead of him, right?
Yeah, they that team could hit pretty well.
Yeah, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Tony Perez were ahead of him. Pete Rose had 6.6 wins above replacement. Bench had 6.2. And again, Bench was 21. Pete Rose was 28. And Tony Perez, 6 wins above replacement. He was 27. So, man, what this team. This really is the beginnings of what we would know as the Big Red Machine.
And this team was really, really young.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why we call it, called the show Building the Machine, because here you can start to see the seeds of what we're going to grow into this powerful club. So August, move into August now. As the Reds finish up July, sort of in the same area, but they've moved a little bit ahead on the basis of a 5-game win streak at the end of July, beginning of August. They moved up to third place just a game and a half out. So they did move up to 10 games over 500 at that time and starting to make some real noise. And actually, by August the 3rd, the Reds tie for first place.
And they had a real pitcher's duel that day.
They did. You were talking about the hitters. Tell us about that game.
Well, the Reds won 19-17. And no, that wasn't a football score. They didn't kick a field goal late to win it. There were 46 hits in this game.
Yikes. Reds had
Bench
25
had five. Alex Johnson had 4. Perez had 4. Rose had 3. Woody Woodward had 3. Lee May hit a home run. Pete Rose hit a home run. Alex Johnson hit a home run. Tony Perez hit a home run. The Reds starter that day was Camilo Pascual.
Purchased on July 7th from the Washington Senators.
I have no idea who he is. I have no memory of him. Or Pedro Ramos, who also pitched that day badly.
Yeah, not very well, no question.
Wayne Granger got the win that day, though, for throwing 3 scoreless innings. And you threw 3 scoreless innings on a day that you win 19-17, that's pretty good.
That's Hall of Fame level right there. 19 runs, you know, there have been most years that since I've been a Reds fan where 19 runs would have been a good week. So anyway, the Reds have, they're tied for the lead now in the National League West, and things are getting a little bit exciting around Cincinnati. It's the Reds, again, had not been to the World Series, the playoffs, had not been to the postseason in 8 years. We're right in the thick of things. August 10th. Gary Nolan retired the first 18 hitters, ended up with a 3-hit complete game, 10-0 versus the Phils. And again, we don't need to go too deep into Gary Nolan right now, but because we're going to be talking about him so much over the course of this series, but he, to me, is one of the great under-known, if that makes sense. That's not really a term, but he should be more well-known amongst Reds fans, it seems like to me, because this guy was as talented a pitcher as maybe the Reds have ever had, just in terms of sheer talent.
Well, and not only that, he transformed himself for some reasons that we'll talk about in the next few episodes. The point that we're talking about now, Nolan was a fireball pitcher. I mean, he could bring it up there. Had a little bit of problem with control at times, but again, a lot of strikeouts. If you look at Nolan's career numbers, early in his career, he pitched a ton of innings. Well, his rookie year when he was 19, he threw 226. Then he had a couple years that he didn't throw as many. And I'm assuming he had some injury problems in 69 here because he only threw 108 innings. But then he threw 250 in 1970 and 244 in 71. I mean, that's a lot of innings. And we'll talk about more of that about this later and some of the things that Gary Nolan goes through and both health-wise and with the ball club.
Absolutely. He's going to be one of the key names as we go through building the machine. Now, the Reds leading up to August 13th, they've won 9 out of 12 games on the 13th of August. They beat Montreal 8-3 in 11 innings, and they, at that time, take a 2.5-game lead, which was their largest of the season to that point. So we're talking about late in the year, you know, mid-August, the Reds are starting to pull away a little bit, 2.5-game lead, right?
As much as anybody pulled away in this division this year.
Yeah, because pretty quickly, at the end of August, they were in second place, a half game behind. And that's the way it was really the whole year. So, but again, that's exciting stuff for many of us Reds fans who've grown up with so many bad seasons that the Reds were not just in the mix, but certainly fully capable of winning. September 3rd, Jim Maloney shut out the Cubs on 2 hits. September 8th, I thought that was a pretty interesting day for Wayne Granger. You want to talk about that day?
Yeah, this is another day that I don't think you would see this happen. In the first game, Granger gets a save where he pitches an inning of relief and he gets a save. Then in the second game of the doubleheader, he throws 8 innings of relief and gets the win.
Yeah, you're not going to see that anymore. That put the Reds back just barely ahead by half a game, right?
Yep.
And we keep talking about this Western Division race being one of the tightest that we've ever seen, but can you kind of give some context on, I think, September 10th right there? That's a good place to talk about how close it was.
Yeah, it's a good bookmark spot because on September the 10th, there were 2 games separating the Reds, the Braves, the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Astros. So you go 1-5, and it's a 2-game separation. That tells you how close this was at this point. And you had no idea who was going to win this division. I mean, you knew, you know, everybody had their favorites, and you know, I can remember as a kid, and this was for myself, this was the first season where I, you know, got the paper every day so that I could see what the I'd listen to the game every night, and the next morning I, you know, had to find the standings to see who won and who lost, and God, they're playing on the West Coast. How do I find out where they won last night? Because you didn't have the internet. You didn't have any of these ways of finding these things out.
Right, right, yeah. So you got to run out to the doorstep in the morning and grab that newspaper. September 12th, the Reds, and this was, again, we talked about September 10th being a bookmark place because it started to kind of go awry for the Reds at that point. September 12th, Juan Marshall one hit the Reds at Candlestick. That was a, just sort of a brutal loss.
Yeah, they got beat 1-0.
1-0. Tommy Helms got the only Reds hit, and that was the day that they dropped out of first place and never regained it. And they went on a pretty rough stretch, really right during that time up through September 20th, didn't they?
The Reds starter that day was Jerry Arrigo.
And he started a number of games that season. He was probably the fifth best starter.
16, he started 16 games for him that year. There's a famous story about Jerry Arrigo and Johnny Bench. And I don't even know if this is true, but I know I've heard it more than once. Where Bench told him to throw the ball harder.
Yes. He was the pitcher in that famous anecdote. I didn't realize he was the pitcher than that.
Yeah, and to make his point, Bench caught his pitch barehanded and threw it back to him.
It may be apocryphal, I don't know, but I've heard that story
like I said,
as well.
I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard it more than once.
So between September 9th and September 20th, the Reds lose 9 of 13 games. Now, and again, to show you how close this division was, 5 of those losses were by one run. And 2 came in a doubleheader to the Dodgers on the 16th. So the Reds were really close to being able to stay in this, but unfortunately it tips the other direction at that time. During that stretch, September 19th to the 28th, good chance to mention your favorite book and mine, Ball 4, right? Because Jim Bouton threw against the Reds 5 times during that stretch.
Yeah, not to steal the thunder of the book, but Bouton starts with the Seattle Pilots, and at some point in the season he's traded to the Houston Astros. So he went from the outhouse to the penthouse. You know, he went from a god awful expansion team to a team fighting in the tightest division race, well, one of the tightest pennant races in history. During this period, he pitched against the Reds 5 times. Some of the games he did better, and some of the games he did worse. The 19th, he threw 2 innings against them and didn't allow a run in a Houston win. And the 21st, he threw 2 innings, gave up 1 run in a game the Reds won. But then once the pennant had been kind of decided, I believe, by then, he threw against the Reds on the 25th, 26th, and 28th, and he gave up 4 runs and an inning and 2/3, so he didn't fare as well that time. But there's quite a bit of talk about the Reds in Ball 4. I wouldn't say quite a bit, but there's a fair amount of talk about the Reds and some derogatory comments about Cincinnati.
That's true, but it's always a good read, always funny. September 26th, Jim Maloney throws a one-hitter versus the Astros. The Reds are still 3 out, and then the following day, the Reds lose 4-3 to the Houston Astros and are eliminated from the National League playoff race. So they hung close for a long time. Ultimately, we'll talk in a moment about how the season finished and what's next, but that wasn't all. Pete Rose had a chance for a batting title that year as well, right? How'd that go?
Yeah, he was leading Clemente by .0008. Going into the last game of the season, and he clinched the batting title with a bunt single.
So the Reds don't win, but can you wrap up what the 1969 season, what happened that year, and kind of run through the season, and then we'll talk about the context of what it means moving forward. Finished 89-73, right?
Yeah, and really, you know, five games above, you know, the, where the Pythagorean says they should have been. They drew almost a million people. You know, they were 13,000 below a million people, which at the time was 8th out of 12th in the National League. But you got to remember they were playing in Crosley Field at the time, which was a much smaller ballpark than they'd be in, they'd go into halfway through the following year.
Pete Rose had a great year, probably the best Reds hitter that year.
Yeah, he won his second consecutive batting title. He won a gold glove. You know, he hit 348, hit 200 hits again, 11 triples. That's a lot of triples, especially for a guy that isn't really fast.
You think maybe it's because he hustled? I heard that he used to hustle.
I heard that he had a nickname. I can't remember what it was.
Oh, he's got plenty of them.
yeah, he's got a lot more now than he used to.
Right, yeah. Certainly on a team of good hitters, but a lot of them young and emerging. That was and maybe Rose's high watermark in some ways. Second consecutive batting title, as you said. Jim Maloney, that was probably his last good year, right?
It was a very good year. He went 12-5, hit an ERA plus of 135. We'll talk about what happens to him in 1970 in our next episode, but you wonder how the Reds might have been different if he'd been able to stay healthy.
Yeah, if he continued to be Jim Maloney for a little bit longer, because again, he was just 29 in 1969. So
another one of them 29-year-old guys.
Right, yeah. And so you wonder what kind of a career he could have had, because he'd been really the mainstay of that rotation for a while once after emerging. So,
and through the mid-60s, I mean, he had been one of the dominant pitchers in the National League. I mean, people spoke of him in the same way they spoke of Drysdale and Koufax and those guys, you know, Gibson and guys like that. I mean, he was that good.
Absolutely. Now, as we talk about building the machine, you mentioned earlier about how young the lineup was. Average age of the Reds hitters was 26.3 years old, third youngest in the National League, but that didn't keep them from being productive, extremely productive, right?
They had four hitters with a WAR above 5, six hitters with an OPS over 122, and then, you know, the WAR above 5, as you said, were Rose, Bench, Perez, and Tolan, and the guys with the big OPS pluses were Rose, Perez, May, Bench, Tolan, and Alex Johnson. The other thing, and I couldn't find this when I went back to look at this, but when you and I talked about this originally, I found somewhere on Baseball Reference where it showed a team's overall age in franchise history. And I think next year's team, the 1970 team, is the youngest team in Reds history. So this one has to be very close to that.
In terms of young hitters, they still led the league in batting average, on base percentage, slugging, and home runs. So it was young, but let's not underestimate how actually productive they were. Fantastic.
To put it in context, you have to remember that they were still playing in Crosley Field. But, you know, a lot of people would say that the batting average and things are going to go up when you start playing on artificial turf, because it helps the hitters because the ball skids. But the ballparks get bigger.
Well, and that's, we talked about transitions in baseball, and one of the things we're going to talk about in our next episode will be the transition to Riverfront Stadium, and then we'll talk about that even more once the Reds make a big trade with the Astros and how that affected the way they approached playing at Riverfront Stadium. That mm-hmm. year, pitcher's average age is 27.3, slightly higher than the league average, below league average in about every category. And the Reds pitching got better, certainly, but it was never the hallmark of the machine, right?
People have always kind of downplayed the big Red machine's pitching, you know, as we get into the crux of the big Red machine into the middle of 70s. But almost every year after 72 or 73, the Reds pitching was above average in the National League. And I don't think many people realize that.
And that's one of our goals here on building the machine, to try to remind people what it was really like with these teams. Now, Bill, do you have any final thoughts about the 1969 team in particular and where its place is in the context of the quote-unquote big Red machine?
I think this team, I think they knew the pitching had to get better or healthier or both. Mr. Hausman probably would have told you at the time that they were getting some young guys in the farm system that were going to help them, but they didn't know how far away they were. They felt like some changes had to be made, and they made them.
Absolutely. So thank you, everyone, for listening to Building the Machine, a brand new podcast series from Red Leg Nation Radio. To get each episode of the show delivered to you automatically, subscribe to Red Leg Nation Radio. You can find us at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, essentially wherever you find podcasts, we're there. Many of the facts, figures, and anecdotes from today's episode came from baseballreference.com and the books Red Leg Journal by Greg Rhodes and John Snyder, and Ball 4 by Jim Bouton. Until next time, for Bill Lack, this is Chad Dotson saying, so long, everyone.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.